Good morning, everyone. I'd like to convene the March 3rd, 2015 meeting of the Agriculture and Natural Resources Committee for the House. Welcome to all. As I mentioned earlier, we're going to hear House Bill 2184 first. I'm going to open a public hearing on that bill. Mr. Gallagher, can you tell us briefly what that bill is about?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the measure directs the Oregon Department of Transportation and Oregon Parks and Recreation Department to provide a link from ODOT website to the Parks and Recreation website for the purpose of providing information about how to purchase day-use parking passes for those state parks requiring them.
Thank you very much. And we have two of our colleagues with us this morning, Senator Thatcher and Representative Stark, if you would care to come forward. Very interesting bill, one that has puzzled myself and the vice chair this morning. So the question that we have is why we have to have a bill. But anyways, thank you for bringing this forward, and look forward to your testimony. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you.
I guess I'll lead off. For the record,
please.
Senator Thatcher from District 13, Kaiser, Newburgh, St. Paul, Wilsonville, Sherwood, King City, and great communities around rural Washington and Clackamas counties. So House Bill 2184 is pretty simple, and yes, I will be answering the question as to why, what's going on here. And we also have some representatives from ODOT and the Parks Department here. The bill does three things. It asks ODOT to put a link in from the DMV website to the Parks and Rec website where there's information about purchasing day-use parking passes. There's a bit of a nexus between driving a car and day use passes of the park, so that's part of it. And it asks the Parks Department to make brochures and other material about purchasing these passes available at the DMVs. It asks the Parks Department to work with other state agencies to see if they would also provide these kinds of informational materials about park passes at their office, you know, something like maybe veterans offices or fish and wildlife or maybe in state forestry or something like that. Now, the Parks and Rec Department just started their budget review in Ways and Means this week, and like many states across the country, it's been a challenge for our state park system to come up with creative financing. This idea was taken from something that other states have done, or at least adapted for Oregon, because it would encourage people to buy the day passes, and if they would like a discount, because those day passes are $5 per car per day, they can buy a 12-month pass for $30 or a 2-year pass for $50, and they're good at 26 day-use parks around the state. So based on what some other states were doing, they were encouraging their state agencies to work together to help promote their programs, and we thought we might kind of try this here in Oregon. And Representative Stark will probably go into a little bit more about what other states have done on this, but I will get to this, why we need this bill. Okay, why can't they just do this? Why can't they work together? Well, as you can imagine, there are some folks at the DMV. It's a great place to, it's a good source for data collection and marketing opportunities. We see all kinds of agencies wanting to pile onto DMV. Well, so DMV representatives here today might elaborate, but is my understanding, because they get so many requests from other agencies and organizations to put links in or other information up on the DMV websites and distribute such information, that the DMV branch offices would appreciate some guidance. In fact, in 2013, the legislature passed a law, it was Senate Bill 762, directing the DMV to add a link from the online vehicle registration renewal system, offering motorists a chance to make a donation to the Veteran Suicide Prevention Program. And this session, there's another bill, Senate Bill 751, requiring DMV to establish an Oregon Donor Registry Fund and link that to as part of the vehicle registration process. So back to the point where I think where all these things are starting to get added into the DMV, why don't we just, you know, do this? I think they would just like some guidance. It really boils down to that. And they would like to see. But here's the thing. After having served on the DMV task force during the interim, almost dealing with something akin to duct tape and paper clips as far as their IT system is concerned. And I think it's dated back to the 1970s, and we can't even accept debit cards and credit cards yet. So so being able to just sell the passes online wouldn't happen. So we would have to just go with a link for now, and they would like some guidance as to which links we would like them to add in. So with that, I'll...
Thank you, Senator, very much.
Good morning, Chair Witt and representatives on the committee. My name is Dwayne Stark, representative for House District 4, which is Southern Oregon, primarily the space between Grants Pass and Medford. So that includes Central Point, Eagle Point, every other point around there, including Rogue River and parts of Josephine County. So I'm here, you know, obviously to support this bill as one of the sponsors of this bill, and to address one more thing on, or reiterate what Senator Thatcher was just saying. DMV is just absolutely bombarded with requests. We're not the first group out here to be, you think, hey, what a logical step. We could utilize DMV for our advantage in other areas beyond ODOT and DMV. And so they get so many requests that they have specifically said, we would like help from the legislature telling us which ones to say yes and which ones to say no to. So this is us trying to help them say yes to something that, to my understanding, they would like to do. And again, they will voice that themselves here in a minute. So this is really a small change that has the opportunity to bring in some big revenue for the state parks. Big is relative, but compared to our state budget, it's not big. Compared to how it actually helps the parks, it can be a big deal. You know, when we first thought about sponsoring this bill or discussed it, I thought it was interesting that, as Senator Thatcher was saying, it's a logical connection. People are going to DMV to register their RVs, or for me, my minivan to haul around all my little children in. And it's a normal thing that we go to DMV for our vehicles, that we then take those vehicles out to the state parks. And as representatives of the state, we want to encourage people to do that. So we just thought that it was a logical connection there. We did some research, and we connected with the National Conference of State Legislators to find out what are some of our other states doing. And they said that actually some of our neighboring states are pioneering the way on this exact connection. Each of them are doing it in different ways, but it gave us an opportunity to see what else is being done in the state. Currently, there of the 40 states that charge an entrance fee for their states, five have now connected to vehicle registration. And there's, again, as I said, there's different ways. Of those five states, three of them have an opt-in option. Literally, where you go in and, like we're suggesting, you can check a box on the website, or when you're filling out the paperwork, you can check a box and say, yes, I want to opt in and purchase now. As Senator Thatcher said, our systems are not set up yet to be able to be that advanced, but we do want to allow them to have that connection. Those three states that are doing the opt-in are Idaho, Kansas, and Michigan. And then there's two states that are actually an opt-out program. Montana and Washington both give opt-out programs. So Montana was the first one to raise funds this way. They automatically charge a $6 fee when people renew their registration. And then there's an opt-out process, and 80% of Montanians have not opted out. So it's brought in some good revenue for them. Washington, with their opt-out program, you actually... if you don't want to pay the $5 fee, they automatically charge you a $5 fee, and then to opt out, you can also opt in to buy an additional Discover Pass, which gives you an annual pass to all their sites. And then finally, Idaho. I read this article recently. I'd encourage you guys to read if you want more information on it. I'm not sure if we uploaded it to OLIS or not, but on Idaho's movement toward doing this. Previously, prior to linking to the state parks on the DMV website, Idahoans, 15,000 were purchasing annual parks passes. When they made this link, that went up. So they took kind of a gamble. They decided, let's cut the fee back to only $10, but let's go ahead and link it and see how many people purchase it. It increased all the way to 96,000 people opted to buy the day use pass. So it had an incredible effect, raised an extra $1 million for their state parks. It's no secret that Oregon is not rolling in money for state parks. I can go into some of the budget numbers on that. I think I'm going to spare you that. If you want to know some of our budget numbers on that, I do have some listed here. So you can ask that question if you'd like. But the simple numbers, a preliminary just kind of guesstimate where we could end up on this. If people come in and they're, whether it's through picking up the brochure information or the website link, if 15% of those people go ahead and check out that information, 15% of people who have that option because it's put before them. Well, if out of that 15%, if 2% actually opt to go ahead and purchase some sort of pass, then we're predicting that that'll raise an increase of $300,000 for the state parks. So simple link creates quite a bit of extra money. It's not a huge dent in the money that they need to operate, but it gets us closer and it helps them out with a simple move of let's add a link and some brochures.
Thank you both very, very much. Questions or comments? Vice Chair McLean.
I guess I had the one question that I had as I was thinking about what you were saying about brochures and how, you know, where will those brochures be made? Will they be made in the Parks Department? Are we just going to get, you know, maybe print an additional 100,000 or something? Or
I don't currently. Maybe they can, because we've talked about this. I don't know exactly where they'll be printed, but I know it's projected to cost around $6,000 to do all of this.
All right.
Well, I imagine they would be produced by the Parks Department.
But that's what I wanted to know was if you had some kind of an estimate on how much those brochures would
right.
cost.
Right. The estimate was for all of the things that we're proposing, cost $6,000 roughly, raises $300,000 hopefully.
Great.
Representative Whitsitt.
I was wondering if you know how much money goes to the state parks from our revenue, from the state lottery revenues.
Let's see. I have in here. See, I should have said it. All right. So let's see. I'll just kind of read you what I have written here. According to the agency, roughly. Wait, I'm going to go back a page. Sorry. All right, half of the funding comes from other funds, as in fees and RV registration, and the other half comes from lottery funds and federal dollars. So I don't know the exact breakdown. The big picture is $218 million is what's carved out in the governor's budget. And current fees, as in for the passes, they produce right now biennium, around $795,000 biennium are produced from 12-month passes, and $786,000 produced from the biennium passes, annual passes, biennium passes. So they're producing about $1.5 million through pass, but that's far from the $218 million that they need to operate.
Okay. I was just wondering why they're using any general funds when we have that much lottery money available that we should be able to take some of that. Do you follow me at all?
Representative?
The parks people, I think, are here.
Oh, okay. Yeah, good. Okay. Yeah, that would be good.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
Probably slightly beyond my pay grade, being my freshman status
sorry.
Here, on the history of how we're doing what with our general and lottery funds.
Thanks. So.
All right, fair enough. Anything further? Well, Representative Stark, I know you mentioned that in part there was a reduction in the cost of a park pass in Idaho, of course. Mm-hmm. I think you probably suggested that a lot of the increased utilization of those passes by the general public was due to making it easier over the internet to buy a pass. But nonetheless, I would be very interested in knowing what portion of that increase might be attributable to a reduction in price. I think possibly, maybe, just might have something to do with encouraging people, making it a little more affordable for folks to be able to access that system. And we have had in this committee before us discussions about the increased costs of hunting and fishing licenses and tags, and there's I think it's safe to say a general concern among many of the members on this committee that those ever increasing prices are driving people away from those outdoor activities and. So if there's any information to be gleaned here and to be had of what what that might suggest for our hunting and fishing licenses. I would be particularly interested in that, if you can find that without any great deal of research. And Senator Thatcher, we will be eagerly awaiting the companion bill that updates, from the two of you, updates the DMV motor vehicles computer system. So, Representative Frederick.
Actually, I was thinking about that as you spoke. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Joint Committee on Information Technology is hearing reports about a number of the IT programs in the state, and I'll be asking a little bit more about the DMV situation as part of that. So, thank you.
Right.
Please.
Chair Witt, thank you for the comments, and I will see what I can find out about what our guesses with the hunting and fishing licenses would be. In response to the Idaho statement, though, you know, I'm guessing it's impossible to really know, was it the decrease in price or increase in access to those passes that really made that change? Every one of these states is trying a different model. We are restricted or confined, in a sense, because of our DMV systems on what model we can attempt at this time. And so I would imagine as we move forward on those systems, we would look at other options as well. But again, we felt like this was a simple way to begin that road and hopefully make a difference for our parks right now. So again, thank you for hearing us this morning.
Thank you both very, very much. Appreciate your appearance today and your testimony. I'd like to call up next, please, Amy Joyce and Larry Warren. Good morning to both of you. Welcome to our committee.
Morning. Sure. We were just debating on who would go first here. So.
Your choice.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, my name is Larry Warren, and I am the Internal Service Administrator of your Oregon Parks and Recreation Department, here this morning to talk about House Bill 2184. And I guess I would ask the chair, did you want me to first address Representative Witsit's question about general funds, or would you like me to?
If you would like, that would be fine.
Excellent. Chair Witt, Representative Witsit, members of the committee, your question, I believe, was why does Oregon Parks and Recreation get general fund dollars if we're getting the lottery fund dollars? And the answer to that question is actually an easy one, which is we get general fund dollars to fund the Fair and Exposition Center, which we are actually going to have going away. It's becoming a quasi-private corporation. So in 15-17, we will have no general fund dollars appropriated to our agency. And in the past, all of the general fund dollars that we received were associated with the Fair and Exposition Center.
Thank you. Please.
I'm trying to figure out why there isn't money in this from this lottery money to pay for what we're looking at in this bill.
Chair Witt, Representative Witsit, members of the committee. From Oregon Parks and Recreation standpoint, we would have a very minimal fiscal impact. Representative Stark talked about $6,000 to print additional brochures. So I don't see us asking for additional funds to fund this bill should it be passed.
Great, thanks.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Okay. Sure. So while Parks is officially neutral on this bill, we do see some positive things about it. As you've heard, we rely quite heavily on user fees and lottery funds to fund Oregon Parks and Recreation. So as such, we're always looking for opportunities to partner and expand folks' knowledge and understanding of the great Oregon Park and Recreation system. So House Bill 2184 would give Oregonians some education on how to purchase annual passes. And as has been mentioned, it's a great value. It's $30 for an annual pass. It's $50 for a two-year pass. It costs you $5 a day if you pay by the day. So if you're a frequent park user and if at a fee day use park, you can see that it only takes half a dozen trips and you've already paid for yourself. So it's great value, and we'd look forward to helping to educate Oregonians on that. As we've already mentioned, minimal cost. We are already in the brochure printing business. We give brochures to chambers of commerce, and we give brochures to various entities. So the fact that this bill asks us to print brochures and give them out to the field offices for the DMV, we can see a large fiscal impact for that. We are in the process currently of building an online system to allow folks to buy their annual permits online. Currently, you have to come in to one of our offices, or you have to go to one of our retail partners to purchase that. But we hope within the next year to have a system up where folks can buy that online. And so we see House Bill 2184 as potentially being a good companion to that effort so that folks can find that quicker. With that said, we want to just mention that we respect the position that DMV is in. We are often also overwhelmed with requests to use our parks for various different marketing and putting information in. So we certainly respect where the DMV is coming from on that feeling. And with that said, we'd just say that we're happy to work with the DMV in any way. So thanks.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Witt and members of the committee. I'm Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation, today representing the DMV. And I want to start out by thanking the senator and the representative for their very gracious testimony about understanding sort of where DMV is kind of put in a position of being sometimes kind of the everything agency. Folks want to put their information, brochures, posters, any number of things in our 60 field offices statewide. And DMV simply takes a bit of a hard line on that and simply says if it's not a DMV or an ODOT related item, we simply don't put things in our field offices. So again, the two parts of the bill are the link on the website and then also putting these brochures in the field office. So the way DMV would implement the bill would be to put a link on DMV's website as indicated in the bill. That's easy enough to do. And then Parks would provide these brochures or postcards. I think I've seen a mock-up with the information in our offices. And understanding that DMV runs 60 field offices statewide, they range from quite large in places like Portland and North Salem and Beaverton and Eugene to very small one or two employee offices that are some of which are only open one day a week. So we have quite a range of where we have these things and very limited space in some of them, which is why we take a hard line on limiting these things. So as Senator Thatcher and Representative Stark indicated, we appreciate the understanding and the perspective of giving direction that if this is the policy direction the legislature chooses for DMV to go and put efforts in this direction, we'd appreciate that direction as opposed to the, sort of the hard line we've taken in the past with public, nonprofit, private organizations, all of which have good causes and want to put things in our offices. I'm thrilled that Senator Thatcher brought up the issue of the DMV Service Transformation Program. She served on the DMV Customer Service Task Force over the interim, the number one recommendation of which was modernize your systems. DMV does have a budget pop in, which I'm sure you'll all be hearing about eventually, and particularly Representative Frederick on the IT subcommittee will be presenting there in a couple of weeks. So we are severely hamstrung by our technology in terms of the idea where Senator Thatcher and Representative Stark would like to go with this idea of reduced parking passes and doing things on DMV's website. But this is a small sort of measure, recognizing that there are competing interests. We can easily implement the bill with our partners at the Parks Department.
Thank you very much. Questions or comments for Mr. Warren or Ms. Joyce? Yes, Vice Chair McLean.
I really appreciate both of you coming in because I know you're overworked and you don't always have enough resources for everything that's going on. But I appreciate both of you being neutral and willing to listen to some good ideas from folks because I do think it's important that we show connection and integration of our services and that we show that we work well together and that we're trying to help provide the public with information on all of our services where appropriate. And it looks like this could be a really, you know, good start to a program that will give you some more potential and opportunities to use that brand new system when you finally get it. And it really looks like a, you know, I mean, when I sit and wait in a DMV office, I would love to be able to sit and read about parks, and I might buy one of those passes. So I think it is a possible idea that if we can make it work at all with little funding, that it sounds like something that would be worth a try. So I'm hoping this goes forward with a positive result.
Thank you very much. Anything else, Representative Whitsitt?
This is sort of beside the point, but I've never had you come before me before, and is this the same computer system that's doing Motor Voter?
Chair Witt and Representative Whitsitt. So DMV currently runs the motor voter program under existing law and has to do with having voter registration cards in the office, and also there's an online where you pass through to the Secretary of State's website to register online. I believe you may be talking about the bill that's currently before the legislature,
yeah,
Representative.
I just wondered if that's the same computer system that you're saying is very antiquated and all.
Chair Witt and Representative Witt said, yes, it's the system that we have is the system that it is, and pulling data from that system and connecting with the Secretary of State is what we do today.
Thanks.
Feeling much more comfortable, Representative?
Boy.
Anything further for this panel? I want to thank you both very, very much.
Thank you.
Have a good day. Anyone else from the public who'd like to testify on House Bill 2184 this morning? Not seeing anyone. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2184. And thank you, Representative Stark, very much for bringing that bill forward. We're not to be outdone by the state of Montana. With that, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2443. Chuck, could you tell us a little bit about this bill?
Chair, members of the committee, the measure increases registration and tonnage fees for distribution, labeling, and registration of various soil-enhancing products, and also increases product evaluation fees.
Thank you very much. And do we have anyone signed up for this bill? Very good. I'd like to call, please, first Katie Koba and anyone else that you would care to have come up with you.
I don't think I can manage this on my own.
Total confidence. Oh. Total confidence. Good morning and welcome to our committee.
It's early in the morning, isn't it? Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Katie Koba, Director of the Department of Agriculture. And yes, I usually don't do these, but Lisa Hansen, my deputy, is out not well today, so I'm going to do the best I can, and I have reinforcements
all right.
Behind me.
Excellent.
Before you this morning is House Bill 2443, which is a fee bill for our fertilizer program, and our fertilizer program is 100% supported by fees in that program. This bill would propose to increase certain fees in the program, and in essence what's driving this fee increase is research in the fertilizer program that was restarted a couple of years ago. And at that time when the industry approached us about wanting us to provide research grants around the interaction between fertilizer and water, we had indicated at that time that providing these grants would eat down our ending fund balance and we would be looking at a fee increase, and that time has come. The bill also increases product evaluation fees when we do some limited product evaluations, and that's a total cost recovery program. And then there are some housekeeping updates in the bill. The fertilizer program within the Department of Agriculture registers, inspects, and licenses the manufacture and distribution of fertilizer, agricultural amendments, soil amendments, lime, gypsum, and compost products offered for sale in Oregon. During fiscal year 2014, the program registered or re-registered over 9,000 products, issued 208 licenses, received tonnage reports from 656 distributors, inspected and sampled 297 products. And the law also provides for the Fertilizer Research Committee, which is indeed the committee that oversees research grants that we might provide out of this program. As I mentioned, a couple of years ago, the industry came to us asking us to basically restart the research program, which had been dormant for about 8 years or so. I think the last grant that was funded out of the program was in 2003, and it was a four-year grant really focused on heavy metals in fertilizer. But based on, in particular, some concerns around nitrates in groundwater in the groundwater-limited region of the Umatilla Basin, the industry felt it was important to restart the program and fund research, and we have done that to the tune of $70,000 for the last few years. So in the proposal, if you turn over to the back side, we have provided a chart for you that outlines what the bill does in terms of fee increases. So for the various product registrations, our current cap in statute is $25. We are proposing that that cap be increased to $50. And right now, the proposed increase that we would carry forward in administrative rule would be $5 on all of those products in the 2015-17 biennium. The evaluation fee is a service that we provide for individuals wanting to introduce new fertilizer products into the state. And what we have found is some of these products have become increasingly complex. This is a total cost recovery service, and the limit is currently $50. Some of our lab tests now cost more than $50. So we would put a cap in the statute of $500, and whatever the cost is to conduct that evaluation would be the cost that we would charge. As you can see on the tonnage fee side, there are no changes proposed for the fertilizer mineral amendment compost gypsum tonnage fees, but we are proposing to institute a 5 cent per ton charge on lime, and then also a $15 minimum tonnage fee for products that aren't generating more than $15 in terms of tonnage. This is a minimum amount because it still requires us to do work to evaluate the reports that are submitted to us and determine if there needs to be a fee or not. So with that, Mr. Chair, I can run through the bill and highlight the sections that have those pieces in it, if you would like me to do that. Section 1 is the tonnage reporting components, and it's down in particular subsections 4 and 5. And this is actually a moving of where it was currently in the statute into a new section in the statute. It appears like it's brand new language, but it is not new language on the tonnage reporting. Section 3 outlines the tonnage tax that we collect, and this is where we would identify the new fee on lime products, the 5 cents per ton for lime, and the new minimum inspection fee of $15. Section 4 is housekeeping language, cleanup in some of the definitions, as is housekeeping, or Section 5 is housekeeping language. Section 6 is housekeeping language, and Section 7 is housekeeping language. Section 8 is the section that contains the evaluation fee amount, moving that from $50 to $500 max. Again, this is a cost recovery evaluation that we provide. Section 9 is just the remainder of the acts, or the bill is just referencing being a round of sections, and Section 19 repeals some statutes, and some of those are moved into different places. So again, the key components of this is an increase in the registration fee cap, adding 5 cents tonnage tax on lime, the minimum tonnage tax fee, as well as the cost recovery increase in statute. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions or comments for Director Koba? Ms. Representative Whitsitt.
I was wondering if you've sent notices to all of your licensed fertilizer distributors in the state of your intent with this bill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Whitsitt, I don't believe we've sent notices to every fee payer, but we spent the last 2 years working with the industry on this fee proposal. As we typically do with all of our programs, we opened up our books, they analyzed the costs, they questioned some of our costs, and really with the goal to determine if there are places in our program where we can streamline and reduce costs, and then we come up basically with this is what we collectively want to do, and then they help us, frankly, balance as well the fees that are currently being collected and where and if we need to institute new fees. So we spend a lot of time with the industry when we're going over fee increases, and I believe you will hear support for this fee increase. I've not heard any opposition. The testimony determine that.
I can follow up. So that would be the wholesalers or the retailers of fertilizer? When you say they...
Mr. Chair, Representative Whitsitt, that would be the the individuals that sell product into the state. We call them the registrants, the manufacturers of fertilizer, and they have to register with us in order to sell those products in the state.
Just one more follow-up. Do you know how this would affect a typical distributor, the retailer, the guy who has a little place out, you know, in the country that's selling this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Whitsitt, when you look at the cost increase, it is fairly negligible. Whether those distributors need to turn around and increase their products at all, they may need to do that slightly. But it is a, you know, we're looking at, for the coming biennium, a $5 increase in registered products. And to what extent the companies pass that on to the dealers is, I think, probably a question mark.
Yes, Representative Barreto, please.
Thank you. Chair Witt, this $70,000 seems like a pretty small amount for R&D. Do most of these fertilizer companies do all of their R&D and then give you the information on that, and then you basically verify it or qualify it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barreto, the $70,000 is not for research and development on fertilizer products. It's targeted research in the state where there are concerns around the impacts in this particular case that I'm most familiar with in Umatilla County, impacts of fertilizer on groundwater and whether application practices are contributing to nitrates in groundwater, if there are practices that producers can put in place that would minimize or eliminate those impacts. So it's more focused on the ground to try to get an understanding of where the nitrates in the groundwater are coming from, what practices are contributing to that, and what practices might be in place, put in place to minimize or eliminate that. So that's what the research funding is targeted on. And we do a competitive grant process, so individuals submit RFPs to us, and our Fertilizer Research Advisory Committee evaluates those and makes funding decisions on research grants.
Are there other organizations or departments that also help with this research?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barreto, we know that Oregon State University has and is doing research on fertilizer issues. There's a lot of funding that comes from the federal government. Again, it's on a competitive basis. And Oregon State University, if you look at our history of research grants out of this program, has been the dominant receiver of grant dollars. But they're a real asset for our industry and are often involved, if not doing the majority of research around fertilizer issues in Oregon.
Thank you.
Further, Vice Chair McLean.
My understanding is that from what you gave us today is that this is a specialized area. It's where people, this competitive grant program, if there is a problem in a certain region of the state, that they have an opportunity to try for these funds and really kind of grind down into the issues in their area.
Mr. Chair, Representative McLean, that's correct. It is targeted, mm-hmm. as Representative Barreto indicated, $70,000 a year on research is not a lot of money.
Right.
And the Research Advisory Committee helps us sort through those proposals for grant funding and really target where we think the greatest need is at the moment.
I really appreciate the fact that you worked with the industry and with the distributors and folks that are buying. I think that's a good model.
Thank you.
Anything further for Director Colbo? Not seeing anyone. Thank you very, very much. Let's see. Figuring out how I'm going to, who I've got in the room. Scott's here. Angela's here. Why don't I have the two of you come up? Good morning to both of you and welcome to our committee.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, Angela Crowley-Cook with Oregon Environmental Council. Thank you for holding this hearing today. Oregon Environmental Council supports the bill before you, and we support the work of the department to process fertilizer registration and also, of course, administer the research grant. But the point that I want to highlight is that OEC agrees with Representative Breda that this is really $70,000 is not a sufficient amount for the research grant program. In the past, ODA has funded grants at a much larger number. In the first 10 years of the program, it was over $100,000 every year. There was that one height of $400,000, that one time for a special project. But then the program went dormant for 8 years, as you've heard, resurrected by the industry who really wants this research. And the reason we need this research is to protect water quality, but also because most experts agree that even though farmers are very cost conscious, there's still room for savings, probably about 30% savings of fertilizer use, which farmers want because it saves them money, but also it has the good impact of reducing runoff and protecting water quality, which we'd rather protect water quality up front rather than have to deal with a contamination issue down the line, especially with groundwater, which is really, really tricky to get that rid of that contamination. So we support a proposal, and we have a bill that we hope to see come before the committee, HB 2718, which would require the department to give out 25 cents a ton of the tonnage tax to the fertilizer grant program every year. At the current level, about $70,000 a year, of all the states that have this type of research program funded by a tonnage tax, Oregon is at the very bottom. And so we're really doing when we have such a big agricultural industry in the state, we're really doing ourselves a disservice by not providing an adequate amount of research dollars for these important research needs that we have as a state. So we do support this, and we know the department and the industry worked really hard to put this bill together, and we really appreciate that. But we need to see more as a state. So I hope to come before you again in the coming weeks to talk about our bill. But just quickly, it's, as I mentioned, increasing the grant fund. In addition, increasing capacity at Oregon State to also help provide some of the expertise that we really need here in Oregon. So I will end there. Thank you for holding this hearing.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
Good morning. Chair Witt, members of the committee, my name is Scott Dahlman, and I'm with Oregonians for Food and Shelter. We're a grassroots coalition. We're made up of farmers, foresters, other pesticide, fertilizer, and biotechnology users. Our membership includes the distributors of these products as well as the end users of these products, and so we have a lot of interest in this bill going forward. We're here today in support of House Bill 2443. We believe that it's a well-crafted bill that is the product of ODA really reaching out to stakeholders to work on a good solution going forward that we could all get behind. I'd like to give the department a lot of credit for coming to us early. As Director Koba mentioned, industry had come to her a couple of years ago asking for the reinstatement of some of those grant fund dollars to do some research. This was coming because we had some grower members of ours who were concerned about some of the data in their area that they felt was pointing towards them as being the driver as some of the groundwater problems, which they didn't believe their practices were actually contributing to. And they were really looking for some resources to be able to go out and do some research to either confirm what was going on or to push back against what was going on. And so we came to them and asked them to reinstate that. It was our understanding that it had kind of gone by the wayside because there hadn't been much demand for a while from people wanting to do the research. But when we started hearing it from our members, we came to them to ask them to reinstate it because it was already on the books. They did that, but at that time let us know that if they were going to start spending dollars on that, that there was going to need to be an increase in the somewhat near future in the overall funding of the program to keep the base program going as well. We are fully supportive of this program. It's important for our industry. It helps ensure that the products match what is labeled so that our distributors know that what they're selling to their customers are what they're expecting to get, and it lets our users know that what they're purchasing matches what's on the label. So having this program in place is really important. So we sat down with them. As they mentioned, they truly opened up their books, allowed us to look at the spreadsheets to see where the costs for the programs were, where the funding for the programs were, to really look at the program going forward. Because if we were going to look at increasing funding, we wanted to make sure that we were setting up the program for a trajectory that was going to be sustainable into the future. While doing that, some things became very quickly apparent, and that's why you will see reflected a little bit of a change of where a lot of the dollars come from to where they come previously. Up to this point, almost all of the funding, or a majority of the funding, I guess I should say, has come from the tonnage tax on fertilizer. A majority of the expenses for the program is for the staff who do the registrations for products. And what we realized was all of your resources going out are going towards something that you're not getting very much funding from. And this especially became true when we started realizing that the staff spent a majority of their time on products in which the registrants didn't have a lot of experience with this. They're not some of the bigger manufacturers or distributors. They're some of these very specialty products that are sold in very small amounts for home growing type use or for very small use. And so what would happen is those people would be able to pay a $25 fee, use an extreme amount of resources of the program, and then at the end of the day would end up paying little or no tonnage tax because that product just wasn't sold in any massive quantities at all. And so there's a couple things in here that help to make that system a little bit more equitable. The first thing is to increase the fees on the registration side. And what that does is now puts a little bit more of the funding coming from where the resources are going. Additionally, adding the product evaluation fee and making that larger so that ODA is able to charge more when some of these registrants are continually using more and more resources. Because at this point, what has happened is Oregon has one of the highest standards in the nation for our labeling of fertilizer products. And so what especially some foreign companies would do is work through the Oregon program, pay a flat $25 fee, use a ton of resources within the department, have them have to send back the label multiple times, asking for multiple corrections, and then at the end of the day, they would have a label that they could use across the country for a flat $25 fee. Good deal for those registrants, bad deal for the department and the program. And so with this evaluation fee, it allows them to charge a little bit more if they're having to continue to do that. We don't believe the department's going to use this unless it is somebody who is using excessive resources, not just somebody who might have a small correction or something, which is a majority of the larger tonnage things that are sold. So the other thing that the bill would do would add a tonnage tax on lime. As you heard from the department, currently there's no tonnage tax on this. This would put a tax with a cap of 5 cents. This is a reinstatement of a tax that had been there previously and went away in 2002. And we are supportive of that as well, to kind of share the load a little bit more about the tonnage taxes paid. And then the last thing that the bill really does is update statutory language to match national language, and this just updates the language within the bill to match the recommendations of the Association of American Plant Food Control Officials. So basically, the departments of ag from other states in the nation, so that our language kind of matches what's going on, removing products that don't exist anymore and adding products that are new to the market, and we support doing this. Last thing I'll say is we know that there might be other bills on fertilizer fees out there, but at this point we think this is the way to move forward. We spent a lot of time working with the department, really digging into this over a couple of year period, and we think that this will be an equitable, sustainable way to fund it going forward, and would ask you to support this bill.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair McLean.
One of the conversations that I heard within the three of you as you made your presentation this morning was that there are different types of research grants out there. Some of them are federal, And I believe that that we had our previous speaker indicate that, that Oregon State University is receiving a lot of those federal dollars for research in this area. So one thing that I think would be helpful for both Representative Barreto and myself from the questions that he's already asked is what is the total that's happening out there as far as research on some of these issues. And so maybe all three of you can take a shot at that. But this is not the only program. I appreciate, especially from the last speaker, what you've talked about as far as the cost of doing business is going to be where the fee is, increase is, because those are the folks that need the resources. I also appreciate the fact that Angela brought up that basically, you know, we need to make sure we've got plenty of dollars or funds or you know, some kind of research being done for a very important area, which is fertilizer and its effect on groundwater or anything else. But from the presentations made today, I have no idea, at least from what I've got in front of me, how much of a body there is out there for these types of research grants or how much of that research is actually being done in state. So I think that would be really helpful. It doesn't have to be today, of course.
I appreciate that that comment, Vice Chair McLean, and perhaps the department could provide each of the committee members a summary of what's out there, because I was struggling and puzzling as I was sitting here with the very same thing. So additional questions or comments for Ms. Crowley-Cook or Mr. Dolman? I'm not seeing any. Thank you both very, very much. Appreciate it. With that, I'd like to call up, please, Bill Hubble and Katie Fast. Good morning and welcome to both of you.
Good morning.
Thank you.
I'll say you go ahead.
Me first?
Yeah.
Okay. My name is Bill Hubble. I'm here representing industry as the manager of Wilco's commercial agronomy division. I also sit on the board of the Far West Agribusiness Association, which represents companies like ours over the Northwest five states. And I was also fortunate enough to be invited to be part of the industry group that worked with Katie's team to try to look at what the issues were, the budget gaps, and come up with ideas about how to solve them. And after being part of that and reviewing the legislation, I'm here to support it. I do believe that it's important to have a strong fertilizer program, not just so that people are getting what they actually pay for, which is important. It also maintains a level playing field to competition in the marketplace, because everybody has to go by the same standards, and supports research. A lot of your questions were great, by the way, and I'm probably not the right research person. I don't have a lot of background in that, but I have been in the industry since 1984, have been active probably in 40 different states over my career, and so one of the questions that came up was about lime. Lime is taxed in many other states. I was actually surprised in the meeting when I found out that it was not in Oregon. So that was actually pretty easy, and the amount is minimal, but the tons are large, so that it could make an impact. One of the, I guess, questions that I heard earlier that I just wanted to try to address had to do with raising the tonnage tax. I like the way the fees are broken out in this bill, because they mirror where the amount of work doesn't equal the revenue that's generated. When you look at raising tonnage taxes alone, they raise the cost of doing business where the large amounts of fertilizer are going. So if you think about fertilizer that goes on grass seed or goes on wheat or the large acre crops, those tend to be the low margin commodities that are grown in the valley. And so when you raise the cost on that, although it would raise a lot of money, it's going to raise the cost on the folks that potentially could least afford it. the costs that are being incurred by the department have more to do with the registration costs, the advisory work that they're doing. And I've been in the middle of that with some of our vendors. You know, we pay registrations on products that we blend. Our vendors pay the registrations on the products that we buy and resell. And we've had products quarantined because there's been label changes made by our vendor, was never submitted to the state, and had it take weeks and multiple emails and reviews by the regulatory department of the company that made the product and Department of Ag folks, just going back and forth. And I felt their pain, you know. So with that said, I feel like I'm rambling, but I support where it's going. I was part of trying to figure out how to put together a fair and equitable program and agree with it.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hubble.
Good morning. For the record, Katie Fass with the Oregon Farm Bureau. Farm Bureau is in support of 2443. And I think in the discussion that we've had this morning, the main thing to remember is that the purpose of the fertilizer program is that when farmers buy a product, or as you as homeowners and gardeners buy a product, that the label is what you're buying, and that the department's doing that work to ensure that what you are paying for is what you're getting. And that's where the fees are based around. And you know, you've heard there's been months of work that have gone into the product of this legislation. There is quite a bit support from the industry for this bill, and we'd like to see it move forward. I would like to touch on the grant program. From the Farm Bureau's perspective, we see the grant program as a supplement benefit of the fee, not a primary purpose of the fee. And it was several of our members in 2011 that came forward to the department, and we had several discussions about some of the needs that they had in unique parts of the state to do some research projects. And after those discussions with the department, reinstating the grant program was seen as the best solution, you know, at a small rate. And I think that $70,000 rate is really what the industry can bear and maintains that our fees are competitive in the region and that we're not, you know, having fees that are extremely higher from Washington or Idaho, and we're uncompetitive. And that program has been successful, and in 2011, when those discussions came forward, you know, we were under the understanding that we'd be coming back with a fee increase in near future. And the work that I think the department has done has created a fee structure that focuses around where their needs are and where it addresses where the amount of work that they're having to do right now is. And has probably a minimal impact on the farmers of our state, you know, in terms of that tonnage fee being remained where it is from majority of the products. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you both very, very much. Is there anything from the committee at this point? I'm not seeing anything. Thank you both
Thank
very
you.
Much for your testimony and your support of the bill. We appreciate that. Is there anyone else at this time who would like to testify on House Bill 2443? Not seeing anyone, I'm going to close the public hearing on that bill. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2183. Mr. Gallagher?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the measure requires persons growing Arundodonax for commercial purposes to file a bond with the Invasive Species Council. Would allow the Invasive Species Council to make grants or loans to eradicate migrating or spreading Arundodonax, and makes violation of the bond requirement subject to civil penalties.
Very good. Thank you. See who we have here. Let's just start right here. Judy's in. Okay, very good. All right, I'd like to call forward, please, Judy Sanders and Billy Don Robinson. Good morning. morning to each of you, and welcome to our committee.
Good morning, Chair Witt. Also with us is Kevin Weidemeyer, a member of the Native Plant Society and a graduate student in botany at Oregon State.
Good morning to you, sir.
Thank you.
Please decide among yourselves the order that you'll proceed.
Thank you, Chair Witt, members of the committee. My name is Judy Sanders. I'm the immediate past president of the Native Plant Society of Oregon and a former member of the Oregon Invasive Species Council. Perhaps most importantly, though, I'm a native Oregonian, the descendant of wagon train pioneers who became farmers and ranchers in our beautiful state. I'm here to speak in favor of HB 2183 for a couple of very significant reasons. The first is that growing Arundodonax commercially in our state represents a serious threat to our state. Arundo is a highly invasive plant. It's listed as one of the world's 100 worst invaders by the Global Invasive Species Database. It was rated as a high risk by APHIS, and you have the map of the distribution of risk area done by APHIS in 2012, so you can see that most of Oregon is in this high-risk area. PGE has been growing or supporting projects to grow Arundo near Boardman. Slide two, please. This is one of their fields, the Frederickson Field, taken at an Invasive Species Council field trip. They had already harvested this field, but they left a row standing there so you could see how nicely the plant grows here in Oregon. Also, I want you to notice how there are a lot of plants sprouting in the field, and I'll talk more about that later. Next picture, please. This is a second field near Boardman, the Three Mile Canyon field, and also you can see it's a very nice stand. They hadn't yet harvested that particular field. In addition to those grow areas, there are feral populations in southern Oregon. Next slide. This is near Talent, I think just south of Representative Esquivel's district. Next picture, same general region taken by a different photographer. Even ODA admits that Arundo is a highly invasive plant. And when they did their most recent highly understated risk assessment, they classified it as a B-level weed, although they didn't list it. My written statement says A-level. That's a typing error. They did give it a B rating. How is it that Arundo goes about invading? Well, primarily it spreads laterally through rhizomes. And those rhizomes can develop huge masses. Next slide, please. This is a first-year rhizome set from the Frederickson field. You can see it's pretty small, but this is just the first year. Over years, it continues to spread. Rhizomes as deep as 9.5 feet can sprout. The plant can also grow from stem segments or from layering. Next slide, please. This is the Frederickson field, and that's what it looks like is going on here. Layering is the process where a stem lays down and then roots. You've probably observed this with blackberries. We certainly have that all over the state. A lot of plants will grow in that fashion. Moreover, research done in California found that attempted mechanical removal of the plants actually spread them. One of the things that Mr. Frederickson suggested was that he was going to use potato harvesters in order to remove the rhizomes from the field, but the research in the Santa Margarita River area indicated that that actually made the problem much worse because it chopped up the rhizomes and spread them around. California Invasive Species Council summarizes it this way. Several studies have shown almost any segment of the stem or rhizome can sprout if it possesses an axillary bud. How do they get dispersed from a field in Boardman to someplace else? They can be spread through water events like flooding or irrigation pipe breaking. They can also be spread through animal transit. In 2013, Tim Butler, who was the ODA's noxious weed director, came to the Invasive Species Council and told us about finding blackberries in Hell's Canyon, I think, and Representative Barreto's district, at elevations and in dry conditions where they didn't think blackberries could even grow. Almost certainly birds were the cause, and birds could spread Arundo in that same fashion. It can also be moved by agricultural transport or by humans who don't clean their clothing or shoes before they leave the field. Aside from the risk of invasion, the consequences of invasion can be disastrous. It disrupts ecosystems, crowds out native plants, and has collateral effects on the fauna, greatest effects on birds, amphibians, and fish. It also clogs waterways and promotes fire. The California Invasive Plant Council says both the likelihood and severity of fires is increased, it restructures river flows, and can cause substantial infrastructure damage in flooding events. A specific fire example was in 2008 with the Southern California Freeway Complex fire. It was largely fed through Arundo, through Carbon Canyon in the Santa Ana River area. It ultimately burned 30,000 acres. It destroyed 187 residential structures, damaged 127 residential structures, costs in excess of $140 million. It's a very flammable plant. A third consequence of Arundo is it wastes enormous amounts of water. In California, it consumes three times the amount as native vegetation. A whole variety of studies were cited on this issue by the Washington State Noxious Weed Board in 2013. Just one of those studies talked about it using 528 gallons of water per square meter. And then they conclude something that I think is connected to what Director Koba was talking about, limited groundwater in the Umatilla Basin. Direct quotation, large stands have also significantly increased water loss from underground aquifers in semi-arid regions due to high evapotranspiration rates. It uses a lot of water. And I think the Confederated Tribes have also submitted some material on this particular issue about water use and tribal rights. Beyond the consequences of invasion, control is difficult and expensive. APHIS concluded in 2010 that Arundo Donax management options are ineffective, expensive, temporary, and have non-target impacts. You can go to the next slide. ODA's risk assessment estimated that control costs with glyphosate, that's Roundup, were about $20,000 per hectare. But in fact, in California, the average cost was $25,000 per acre, three times as much. If you look at the actual cost, because they varied greatly in California, the minimum cost was $4,700 per acre. The maximum cost was $64,000 per acre. Why is it so expensive? Well, first of all, it's hard to find small plants. It's no problem to find a 12-foot Arundo plant, but they start small. They look like grass. They're often hidden in the canopy. And by the time you can see them, it's a well-established colony. Beyond that, control and eradication require removal of all the rhizomes and roots because segments can break off and the biomass atop the soil so you don't get layering or stem segment growth. APHIS reports that if you use glyphosate, it will probably require application of 3 to 5 years for local control. That, and also that chemical methods aren't feasible for large-scale infestations, and there are a lot of non-target impacts. APHIS also goes on to report that mechanical methods are very expensive and often ineffective. So it's very, very difficult to control this plant. It's obvious that it represents a significant risk. The second reason I'm in favor of HB 2183 is that we need protection from the plant. When Arundo escapes, the people of the state of Oregon should not have to pay the cost for eradication and control. The California Invasive Species Council reports that Orange County, California, which has less than 1% of the land mass of Oregon, spent $40 million trying to control it in the 15 years before 2011, and they were still fighting the battle. Unless we plan to take the kicker tax from our citizens, we don't have that kind of money. We can't trust commercial producers that they're going to clean up and eradicate it. A tragic case is yellow-tufted alyssum in southern Oregon. I think that's in Representative Krieger's district or next to it, where Texas company Viridian came in with their scheme to mine nickel with yellow-tufted alyssum. It proved to be a huge debacle. They abandoned the project, leaving the plants to invade the serpentine soils of southern Oregon. As of 2012, ODA and the federal government had spent $300,000 trying to eradicate yellow-tufted alyssum. And last November, Dan Hilburn, then plant programs director at ODA, reported that they were still fighting yellow-tufted alyssum in southern Oregon. even if PGE abandons its plan to grow 50 to 90,000 acres of Arundo, currently anybody else could come in and plant it. ODA does have some current rules, but they're not sufficient to protect the people of the state of Oregon. First of all, the bond requirement is too low. The bond requirement in the ODA rules is a measly $100 per acre. That is dramatically less than the minimum cost in California of $4,700, and of course less than ODA's estimate and less than the average in California. Secondly, the ODA rules don't have any enforcement means. A wonderful aspect to this bill is that it provides for civil fine enforcement to make sure people do in fact have bonds. Third, ODA's rules require entirely on ODA. Now, ODA is a good-meaning agency for sure, but there can be conflicts in this situation. I'm sure it's an issue that is very familiar to this committee. ODA's mission requires them to favor farmers, ranchers, and agribusiness. They have, as part of their target, protecting the natural resources for the benefit of farmers and ranchers. And that might not be for the benefits of all of the people of the state of Oregon. This bill, on the other hand, gives jurisdiction over bonding to the Invasive Species Council, which is an independent agency whose sole job it is to protect Oregon from invasive species. One final comment I want to make on the bill, which is that a deficiency is that 1 year post-protection is too short. The research from APHIS indicates 3 to 5 years at minimum. The freeway complex fire in Southern California in 2008, 7 years later, with the cooperation of 8 agencies, multiple years of spraying and biomass removal, still hasn't been able to completely eradicate Arundo in Carbon Canyon. There's a little bit left. They've mostly gotten rid of it, but it takes a long time to eradicate this. 1 year won't save us. I think Oregonians need 2183 to protect us all. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, I'm Billy Don Robinson. I am State Vice President, Native Plant Society. I chair our legislative committee. You have the prepared statement I submitted. I'll just read a little bit of it, but I want to get on to some visuals quickly. Portland General Electric's option to plant many tens of thousands of acres of catastrophic invasive species threatens every streamside habitat in the Columbia River drainage. This species, Arundodonax, is considered to be a fuel substitute for Portland General Electric's coal-fired energy plant at Boardman. Arundodonax, or giant cane, cannot be contained. It will inevitably escape control if planted on an industrial scale. Once giant cane escapes from multiple widely dispersed infestations, it cannot be eradicated effectively. This assertion has already been established in Texas and California. More concerning, in some ways, is the huge economic losses that will follow should PGE's option be executed. It's deeply troubling. Farmers and taxpayers, as well as those with jobs in the non-extractive natural resources sector of Oregon's economy, like tourism, will suffer. This will happen in areas where jobs are extremely hard to find. Creating appropriate levels of bonding are a last-ditch effort to mitigate against any industrial use of Arundodonax, be it as a coal substitute or as a source for production of cellulosic ethanol. So let's go ahead and just take a look at a couple things here. Now, as you can see, this is how it grows around bridges. In the Santa Ana River Basin, it's grown so thick, it changes the hydrology of the river. The water flows around the Arundodonax. Instead of going under the bridge, it undercuts it. Got to replace the bridge. That's one thing. Here's a little look at manual, or rather machine eradication. Look at the size of that stuff. Here's another view from that bridge area. This is a 10-year-old stand, 100% cover. Nothing else grows, just Arundo. Can you imagine that along, say, the Deschutes River or along the Metolius? The little mom and pop bait and tackle shop, the bed and breakfast, we can kiss them goodbye. There will be no business. No way you can get a raft into a river like that. It's over. Look at that. They're layering it over, trying to protect a native tree. It's being prepared for foliar herbicide. I don't know how many thousands of gallons of Roundup you're going to have to use to get to the leaves at the bottom of that mess. And this is why it is so deadly dangerous. It crowds out every other plant. It provides dens for coyotes. They like it. Of course, you have a collapse of all other mammals when the coyotes hunt them, then the coyotes collapse. Also, raptors, like birds of prey, like to get up on top of it. And again, you know, the deleterious effect on our fauna is terrible. There it is in Talent, Oregon, coming right up. The significant thing about this visual is California has been fighting this stuff, $25,000 an acre at a time. It has moved all the way from the Santa Ana River Valley in far southern California all the way up the state of California. That is a feral population that we've identified in Talent, Oregon. Now, here is the riparian zone on Stony Creek. It's just north of Orland. It's just a little bit south of our line. And that's what it looks like as it is beginning to invade and dominate that riparian habitat. It's not so bad yet, but nothing's stopping it. There's a little bit more. You can see it on the far side of the creek there. Getting pretty thick. So, I grew up on a little farm. We raised hay, okay? And that's not all we did. You know, we worked in the steel mill and stuff, but that hay crop is really important to us. You know, there are many nightmare scenarios here. But let's take a moment to reflect on a hay farmer out in eastern Oregon who is told by Portland General Electric that one pass with Roundup in 1 year will eliminate, you know, this Arundo Donax, and they can rotate their crop up back over to alfalfa. Well, the science is clear. 1 year doesn't do it. 2 years doesn't do it. 3 years barely does it because these tubers are active, and some of them are inactive, okay? When you apply Roundup, it's taken up through the green leaves and goes down and kills the active tubers, does not address the inactive tubers down the ground. It's like a time bomb. Next season, you know, they come up. That's the second year. So let's say a farmer, based on what Portland General Electric says, rotates and starts growing alfalfa. Well, it's full of Arundo Donax. You can't really tell. That farmer exports that to, say, China or Japan. Well, we know how they really don't like getting stuff that they didn't expect. Does that lead to the collapse of the export market for alfalfa in eastern Oregon? How long would it take to restore that? And what would it do to that family? So, you know, that's about all I have to say this morning. And thank you so much, Chair Witt, and members of the committee. We deeply appreciate it.
Absolutely. Good morning, sir.
Hello, Chair Witt, members of the committee. My name is Kevin Weidemeyer. I'm a PhD candidate in the Botany and Plant Pathology Department at Oregon State University. I think my colleagues have done a great job summarizing our arguments. I submitted some written testimony as well that highlight two studies that I think are important with particular relevance to Arundo Donax in Oregon. First by Nackley looked at the environmental tolerances of this plant and how wide they are. And they quote, their findings suggest that it is unlikely Arundo Donax will be constrained by the agricultural setting and therefore cultivating it will disperse it into new environments and will likely lead to future invasions. And the second study was just completed last year from scientists at Portland State University. And in particular, I want to point out that this study was done actually on the Arundo stand that's growing in Boardman. So it's actually in the field and in Oregon. And they find that the data presented here indicates that Arundo donax thrives in the Columbia River Basin agricultural area, and that it also produces significantly greater amounts of volatile organic compounds than the previous literature suggests. So I think that just points out that although we have not seen a lot of Arundo, thankfully, in Oregon so far, that it can thrive here and can escape from the agricultural setting into our streams. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Representative Whitson.
I was wondering if you could discuss the cellulosic component of Arundo dono, however you pronounce it, donax. Would this be something that would be used to meet our low carbon fuel standard in the state that we're discussing right now, or is this high cellulosic? I know it's a lignocellulosic, which is hard to break the sugars away, right? So could you just talk to us a little bit about how this would relate to the production of ethanol to meet the low carbon fuel standard, please?
Chair Witt, Representative Whitson, happy to address that. In 2013, Native Plant Society introduced House Bill 2813. Our intent was by act of legislature to declare Arundo donax Class A invasive and further to enjoin the Department of Agriculture from permitting it by special permit, because they have the capacity now to allow any entity to plant this, be it Class A noxious or not. Okay. Part of my testimony was the Sierra magazine, Sierra Club magazine, and on page 26 in this particular article, they talk about cellulosic ethanol production, and there is an Italian company, Chemtex International, and in this year they said Chemtex International will open a commercial cellulosic ethanol plant in Clinton, North Carolina, one of several under construction. The factory is expected to produce 20 million gallons of biofuel a year, a third of it from 100,000 tons of locally grown Arundo. So it is certainly feasible, and investments on an industrial scale are happening or were happening in 2013. So, yes, it is effective as a source for cellulosic ethanol.
So I'm just wondering out loud if we would be expecting, because the state has to meet a certain low carbon fuel standard, that we would see this potentially grown throughout the state on a commercial, not just PGE, but other groups coming in and growing this commercially in the state to meet the low carbon fuel standard.
That,
any ideas?
Chair Witt, Representative Whitsett, that is our deep and abiding fear. If PGE walks away from it, because they've been saying, well, maybe it doesn't pencil out. You'll hear them say that. Still, with the Department of Agriculture's permitting ability to allow the commercial exploitation of a Class A noxious species, should it be identified as that, yes, Chemtex International could certainly roll right in and be greeted under the current rule.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Barreto, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is that the primary use for it? Is that what Three Mile Farms was growing it for over there? Were they growing it for silage? Or?
Chair Witt, Representative Barreto, I'm a little deaf in this ear.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I was a logger for a lot of years. Too much chainsaw,
in the
sorry.
In the film there, they had showed Three Mile Canyon Farm, I think, growing it over there, and I wondered if they were growing it for silage or if they were growing it for... fuel?
Chair Witt, Representative Barreto, they are growing it as part of the PGE project. Their plan is to torrefy it and try to use it to replace coal in the Boardman electrical plant. They were originally going to do a test fire on that last year. They haven't done it yet. Now I think they're scheduling test firing this year. But that's a PGE-supported project.
Representative McEwen.
Thank you, Chair Witt. I greatly appreciate your testimony today. I have an issue in my district where our watershed has fallen prey to Japanese knotweed, which is a very similar type of, I think the invasion technique is similar. It's a flood event, comes down the creek, another flood event gets further down the creek, and we're having serious, serious issues with Japanese knotweed. So I've seen it firsthand and understand your grave concern about the potential for this to get into the wild. It's devastating. So I appreciate you drawing our attention to this today. It's a serious issue, and look forward to seeing how we can try and address it in a way that's meaningful and helpful, because this is serious stuff.
Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Chair Witt. It's good to see you again, Billy Don.
Thank you, Representative Frederick.
He's one of my Chair constituents. I am concerned. I have heard that it is because of our weather, because of where we are in the climate, that this is not something that would grow particularly well. Would you please address that? I know that they planted quite a bit this last year or the year before, and it didn't grow as well as they had hoped. So was this just a particular weather event, or was it is it able to sustain the weather of this particular climate right now?
Chair Witt, Representative Frederick, it may not have grown as well as PGE was hoping. It didn't grow as tall as the stands that you saw from Billy Don's picture where it was all bent over. But it did grow pretty well. You saw the pictures from the Boardman fields. It grew huge stands there. They also were not able to, at least when we did the invasive species field trip, they were not able to harvest the product three times a year, which was their initial hope. That doesn't mean, however, that it's not going to be invasive or a huge problem. It's certainly climate compatible. The pictures demonstrate that. That's what the research that Kevin was talking about demonstrate. Whether it is big enough to make it a good economic choice for PGE is not the same issue as, is this going to be an invasive plant if we grow a lot more of it? And clearly there's a sufficient climate match. I think, again, the APHIS research that indicates risk potential across almost all of Oregon, that red map at the very beginning, suggests that's the problem, even if PGE doesn't decide it's a good economic choice for them.
Follow-up. There is a significant. There was a professor, and I've forgotten his name, who's doing the work. And maybe it's Fredrickson. I would be surprised if I'd forgotten that name. But in Washington State University, where is that research right now, and what is that indicating at this point?
Chair Witt, Representative Frederick, I'm not quite sure which research you're talking about. There have actually been a couple of different studies at Washington State. They did a study at Prosser where they did a grow for several years, and then they eradicated it. And that study was completed, gosh, I honestly don't remember. It was a number of years ago. It's a little different there. It is a little colder there. It requires maintenance and a lot of water. So I'm not sure that they gave us completely the full picture on how Arundo grows in that particular study. That it didn't, it is true in the Prosser study, it didn't become invasive across southern Washington, but that was a very short-term study. And actually, if you look at the history of the invasion in California, they had Arundo in California for many decades before it became a problem. What's true of most invasive species is that the process of invasion is not a nice linear
a graph like that. In fact, it's more like this and then a huge jump. So you're not going to see that invasive response in that short period of time. I will say if you looked at the Three Mile Canyon field, you could see that there were already plants eking outside of the field range. They had to be watered to grow, but obviously the roots were weakening. Going back into the area where there was water. At the Hermiston station, they were not able to grow it very well. Whether that was an issue of water or whether it was an issue of the nature of the dirt isn't revealed yet in the literature. I think they know the answer.
And one last thing.
Yes, please.
It is an ornamental. I have, and we've seen it used, it sold in the nurseries a number of places. I actually saw it along in Canyon, in Cannon Beach area at mm-hmm. one time because it looked as though someone had tossed it out, basically. Do we have that, because it's been around, because it's been an ornamental, have we seen that kind of invasion or have we seen that kind of dispersal?
Chair Witt, Representative Frederick, we have not, but we don't have very much of it. Although it is an ornamental in the state that is available, we'd actually like to see the state eliminate selling it as an ornamental. There just hasn't been enough to see that huge effect. It's quite likely that the feral population in Talent was as a result of an ornamental planting. There was a previous feral population in southern Oregon on Bear Creek, which was probably an escape from an ornamental planting. It's hard to trace exactly where it came from, but that seems the most likely. So it hasn't been enormously invasive, but it's much different when you've got a couple of people in town who have a pot of Arundodonax or who have it right in front of their house than when you plant 50 to 90,000 acres of it. The literature on invasion also indicates that one of the huge risks of invasion has to do with how much of the plant is available in the ecoregion. They call it propagule pressure. The more you plant of it, the greater the risk of invasion. Thank you.
Representative Woodson.
And I don't know if you can answer this, but what would 1 acre of Arundodonax convert to in terms of ethanol, of gallons of ethanol? Do you have any idea?
Chair Witt, Representative Witsit, that's beyond the scope of our study. I apologize.
That's fine.
Chair Witt.
Representative McEwen.
Thank you, Chair Witt. It might be helpful to the panel if you could explain the difference between cellulosic biofuel in the form of ethanol and torrefaction, if you're familiar. I think there's some confusion.
Chair Witt, Representative McCown.
McEwen. That's
McEwen.
Okay. You get a pass.
Thank you. Two different processes entirely. Think about, let's say you got some wood and you turn that into charcoal and you use that to, run your barbecue, I guess. That's one way to get heat from it. You take a green standing tree, you subject it to heat, and that turns it into charcoal. That's torrefaction. Now, the reason PGE is so interested in it is because they want something that's similar to coal that they can burn in their coal-fired plant without having to, rework it, so to speak, re-engineer it. Cellulosic ethanol, you take the green plant and then you subject it to chemical treatment and you break it down chemically in such a way that alcohol is the byproduct of the process, and then you blend that into gasoline. And
I think my point was there may be some confusion about what PGE was trying to do with this particular plant matter in the Boardman area. It wasn't for cellulosic biofuel, it was for torrefaction to fuel their coal-fired plant, and torrefaction is something that's not commonly understood, I don't think. So this is not an ethanol cellulosic biofuel process they're trying to do.
No,
ma'am.
Is that
correct? I can't speak for PGE. That's what I'm hearing you say. Is that
yes.
correct?
Yes. Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mr. Weidemeyer, you're a PhD candidate, you said, at OSU. What department?
I'm in the botany and plant pathology department there.
The botany department. Your panel has succeeded in alarming me to the point that I share Representative McEwen's concerns about a repeat of Japanese knotwood or purple loosestrife, but in this instance of the 14-foot variety. Terra firma, I guess it would be Scotch broom. With that concern in my mind, Mr. Weidemeyer, I don't want to characterize your statement or your concerns, but you certainly have come forward and said that you personally, I think, are concerned about this cane product, and that you're worried about it potentially spreading, and that we ought to be careful in enabling it to spread or propagating it. Hopefully that's somewhat accurate. Would you say that the majority of your colleagues in the botany department share those concerns and that level of concern?
Chair Witt, members of the committee, most of my colleagues in the botany department, to my knowledge, don't directly study Arundo. I'm basing this off of other studies that I've found perusing through the literature, particularly this one out of Portland State University, where a team of physiologists made really precise measurements of the plants in the field, actually in situ in the Columbia River Gorge. And they found that the plants were thriving there. And Representative McEwen's comparison with the Japanese knotweed is really apt, I think, because while Arundo hasn't been shown to produce viable seeds in North America, where it's invading, this process of the layering and the rhizome sprouting is how it spreads in North America, and it's very similar to how the Japanese knotweed spreads as well. But I haven't heard, I'm not aware of people, particularly in the botany department, studying Arundo.
Yes, Representative McEwen. Sure,
thank you. And I did a little reading on this last night because it intrigued me. And when you look at the kind of the overall qualities of this particular plant, it doesn't have a lot of redeeming qualities. I understand that cattle don't like it particularly. Goats will eat it if they have to, but it's not their first choice. It doesn't have a lot of uses except possibly torrefaction or cellulosic biofuel. But as an agricultural product beyond that, it doesn't really have a lot of redeeming value. Is that correct? I mean,
we
know a lot more about this than those of us who are not botany PhD candidates.
Yeah, sure. What, Representative McEwen, of course. My understanding is that its primary advantage is that it is extremely aggressive and grows extremely quickly, up to several centimeters a day in height. And so for some of its bulk uses, it's primarily used for that. Unfortunately, that same quality makes it a terrible invader, its extreme aggressive nature and ability to spread. So.
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The invasion, I was thinking, sounded a lot more like War of the Worlds. And it is, you know, a little bit frightening when you talk about these things. We have yellow star at this loper where we are. But you said 3 years for Roundup, you know, treating it with Roundup. Does the Roundup go down and actually kill the rhizomes, or do they stay dormant for a while?
Chair Witt, Representative Barreto, the glyphosate molecule is the active ingredient. Roundup has a surfactant added to it, so it scrubs it in at the cellular level. The by the way, the surfactant is listed as an inert ingredient, but it kills every amphibian it comes in contact, and that's just the inert ingredient. As far as killing rhizomes, yes, definitely. The way the glyphosate molecule transfers to the tubers, if you will, the rhizomes, is it's sprayed on green matter and is absorbed and becomes systemic in the organism to the point that the tuber or the rhizome is active. It does not address inactive tubers, which, you know, that would be year two, year three, 3 years at a minimum, and that's...
Yeah, do they stay dormant in the follow-up?
Please.
Do they stay dormant then in the ground and for how long?
Chair Witt, Representative Barreto, 3 years minimum. I think in your testimony, we were talking seven. It's a real ticking time bomb down in the ground.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Representative Woodsett.
You made a statement, and I wasn't sure that I got it, that it was $40 million to control. Was that the state of California? Oh, what was that exactly?
Chair Witt, Representative Woodsett, that is the 15-year time period from before 2011, and it's in Orange County, California only, which is about 1% of our land mass. I didn't bring the total California cost figures. I certainly could provide them to you. I have them. But it is substantially higher than just Orange County's costs.
So follow up.
Please.
So is that the local government, or where do you come up with the numbers, the $40 million?
Representative Witsit, that's a little difficult for me.
Yeah.
The figures come from the California Invasive Plant Council.
Okay, thank you.
Anything further? I would like to recognize the students and faculty from Nestucca Valley Schools. Welcome to our committee this morning, and welcome to the Oregon State Capitol. We're having a hearing right now on House Bill 2183, which has as its topic Arundo nonex, which is a cane type plant, and has the potential for being an exceedingly aggressive invasive species. And I would characterize this panel's testimony as exceedingly cautionary to us in terms of the potential for that plant to possibly spread through much of our state's waterways and riparian zones. So welcome to each of you. Seeing no further questions or comments from the committee, I want to thank this panel very, very much for your testimony. We are on alert, I assure you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
With that, I'd like to call up, please, Brendan McCarthy and Katie Koba, Director Koba.
Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Brendan McCarthy. I'm here representing Portland General Electric. It's good that I can speak actually to what it is actually my company's doing on a boardman replacement and by growing Arundo donax in eastern Oregon, and do it in my own words. So Portland General Electric is an investor-owned utility. We have 842,000 customers. We serve a service territory of about 4,000 square miles. Our service territory and the people in it are responsible for 70% of the state's GDP. Thanks. We are under mandates from the legislature to increase our renewable component of the electricity that we serve our customers with. And the Boardman Replacement Project is one of those things that we're looking at. Utility-scale wind is the predominant resource we've used to boost our renewables. But with the closure of Boardman in 2020, we saw possible avenue for converting that plant and reusing what we consider to be a relatively new coal-fired power plant, retaining 110 full-time jobs, 225 seasonal jobs when we clean that plant in an area of the state that can use those jobs, and retain the asset in our portfolio to continue to generate safe, reliable, low-cost power for our customers. It's somewhat ironic that we're here today discussing the invasive nature of this plant, while at the same time we are gradually reducing the number of acres we have in production, because we have found through our R&D experiment that Arundo has not been growing particularly well for us. It's been not been meeting our expectations. So we are reducing an additional field this year. Greenwood Resources was growing for us last year. They had some difficulties with frost kill and ultimate growth as well, using a drip irrigation system. Didn't work out so well for them. And now we are taking the rhizomes out of the second to last field and planting them more densely in the final field. So we're reducing our acreage dramatically. So on to my prepared comments. Generally speaking, we do not believe the bill is necessary. We've been working closely and collaboratively with a whole host of people from the time we planted Arundo in 2011 through now, including Morrill County officials, the Department of Agriculture, Agriculture Research Station out in Hermiston, including the Oregon Invasive Species Council, seeking, getting advice on how to grow this plant safely. We initially worked with the Morrill County to institute a series of voluntary growing restrictions that keep us out of the waterways, a quarter mile away from sources of water. We've been extraordinarily careful about how we have started growing this plant, keeping in mind this is an R&D project, and we've learned quite a lot. We have not only developed these restrictions with Morrill County, but we've actually, in a sense, from whole cloth, created the way we treat growing, transporting, and harvesting this plant in a safe manner. There was one instance where we had to send some of this material to Idaho to have it tested at a research facility there for its potential for torrefaction. I called the Department of Idaho's Department of Agriculture, State of Idaho's Department of Agriculture, and said, "Do you have any restrictions on transporting this?" They said, "No." I said, "Well, you know, we're really concerned. So, you know, should we bale it? Oh, that would be good. Should we cover the bales? Absolutely. Should we wash the trucks out with hot water when we're done? Absolutely. Should we inspect for fragments? Absolutely." You know, that was entirely on us. And we created checklists for our growers, sanitation requirement checklists for our growers and harvesters. So we've been extraordinarily careful. We recognize what the Native Plant Society is concerned about. We recognize that in some areas of this country, this plant is invasive and has caused damage and is expensive to remove. So we are extraordinarily careful. We voluntarily presented our work to the Oregon Invasive Species Council. As you saw in the pictures, we've had them out for tours of our fields. I don't think that there has been a more open growing of this plant in Oregon. In fact, before we started growing this, I've actually talked with people who have grown this plant before us. And they didn't do any of these things. They thought, well, here's an economic agricultural crop. Let's investigate it and see whether it works. But since I think to some extent, since we took such an open approach to growing the plant, we've actually seen more of a concern, and again, legitimate, from the Native Plant Society about growing in Oregon. But prior to our growing it, there were absolutely no restrictions to growing it in Oregon, none. So due to our project, I think we've improved our state's knowledge of this species. I think we've improved our knowledge of how to cultivate it or not, whether it shows signs of spreading in the area that we're growing it in. We've subjected it to a number of tests, breakage tests for wind. Actually, one of the pictures that Ms. Sanders used with the layering effect, we actually tested the layering, and concerns about whether if it were laying in the field, would it sprout? We put some on the edge of the field and continued to water it to see whether it would sprout. We took rhizomes, took 200 rhizomes, and put them in a greenhouse and subjected them to perfect growing conditions to see whether we could get them to sprout, the nodal pieces. We found none of them out of 200 sprouted. So again, every step of the way, when people present concerns to us, we actually look at them and address them, test them. And that's what an R&D project is about. So as we found that this hasn't worked for us, not to say that we wouldn't consider at some point in time using this as a one of the streams of fuel supply if the Boardman facility is converted, if the torrefaction project that we're working on in conjunction with this growing operation works. Not to say that this couldn't potentially serve as a fuel source. We have begun investigating other sources. Now, you know, again, the very things that make this attractive to PGE are the very things that make it invasive. You know, with a bio crop, you want something that's productive. And most extremely productive crops are extremely productive because their natures, they are and potentially have that aspect of being invasive. There were crops that we looked at that are used around the country that we discounted immediately from our R&D project because we felt as though the danger was just too great, and we discounted them immediately. Arundo appealed to us for a variety of reasons. And because of some of its characteristics, but it was within a limited subset of plants that we even considered. Now, finally, as we move forward, we are working with the Morrow County Soil and Water Conservation District to provide field monitoring, proactive field monitoring into the future. We've taken pictures of road crossings and stream areas in a before and after situation to ensure that we don't find any crops growing later, so we can actually compare the before and after. This effort was requested by us. We're taking an early detection and rapid response approach to finding any escaped populations, of which I am not aware that we've actually found any. And again, our early work on this was work that was eventually used by the department in establishing their growing rules to begin with. So I thank you for your time. I obviously am available to answer any questions when the director is done with her testimony. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Katie Koba, Director of the Department of Agriculture. I distributed for you a chart that compares the Department of Agriculture control area authorities and the steps that we have put in place related to Arundo and compared to the bill that is before you. Before I go through this briefly, I do want to share with you our commitment to addressing invasive species issues in this state. We are very, very committed and concerned about invasive species, and it is a priority for our agency. In addition, we have the state weed program that is housed within our agency, and that is the program that's been dealing with Arundo Donax in the state. The department also has the control area authority, whereby we can set up control areas to deal with plant pest and disease and noxious weed issues. And we have now established a control area which is statewide to deal with Arundo Donax, and that's outlined in the chart that I've presented to you. This control area was established because of PGE's interest in growing Arundo Donax commercially in the Umatilla Basin area. So as you can see in going through the chart, the control area now has been established. It's a statewide control area. It prohibits the planting, propagation, purchasing, you name it, of anything Arundo Donax unless they have applied to the department and received a permit from the department in order to plant it. It outlines for you the kinds of conditions that we can place on a permit, and that is the process that we go through when we establish control areas and permit conditions. The bond that we are requiring from PGE on this particular case is $1 million. So we have put in place an $1 million bond, which is one of the requirements that's in the bill before you.
We have requirements in terms of monitoring for 3 years after production ceases to make sure that it is not spreading, and if it appears that it is, then we have requirements in place to eradicate that spread. The last piece that I would highlight that is a difference between our current civil penalty authority, which is a maximum of $10,000, versus what is being proposed in the bill, which is $25,000. So that is a difference between our current authorities and what's proposed in the bill. The other thing that I would point out for you, you have in your materials a recently completed study from Oregon State University, Agronomy of Arundel Donax in North Central Oregon, dated October 1st of 2014. So this is a recently completed report. I'll let you read it at your leisure, but I think one of the things that I would highlight in the executive summary is that according to this study, Arundo is relatively difficult to establish under conditions characteristic of the Columbia River Basin. Our research suggests that the likelihood of Arundo becoming established inadvertently from harvested nodes or from escape into artificial or natural waterways is unlikely. But you have the complete report in front of you. The department, just to clarify, we're not taking a position on the bill. We're just here merely to provide information about what we have currently put in place and the differences between what we have in place and what is being proposed in the bill.
Thank you very much. Representative Whitson.
Thank you. I think this really comes down to climate. What you're looking at Boardman is not the same climate as we have in southern Oregon along Talent and that area and the Willamette Valley and the coastal areas. And so I think to take one thing is like comparing apples to oranges. When we have sort of outlier wild patches of this growing already in the warmer areas, I mean, I don't think we can compare these two areas. For me, I see it as a difference between riparian and warmer climate versus colder, not put right next to the Columbia River. So I don't know if you have any comments on that, but given the propensity for this to grow in California and our climate in southern Oregon, meaning Medford, the Rogue Valley, and all the way up, it seems like this would be like maybe you need two separate, different ways to address the growth of this, the colder, higher climate that's drier and needs irrigation versus the riparian, warmer western Oregon. I mean, that's my concern, is the spread of this in that part of the state that is the western part west of the Cascades. So question there, if you see this plot that you've studied as being applicable to all of Oregon, or if you think there are varying factors.
Mr. Chair, Representative Whitsitt, and I do have scientists with me who deal with this on a more regular basis than I do if I don't answer your question adequately, but that is indeed what we would look into in any permit request that came to the department to grow it. We know that if you're growing it near water, that's not a good thing, and when a permit request comes in, they have to include a map of their growing locations and identify nearby waterways, so we would put requirements in place to prevent escape into waterway, and I would guess that we would have a lot more concern about a permit requesting to grow it on the west side of the state than on the east side for that very reason.
Vice Chair McLean.
I just appreciate this very much, and I think both of us probably were looking at the same points here. But a statewide control area, and then your B was giant reed shall not be planted, grown, or stored in riparian areas, wetlands, or special floodplain areas, 100-year floodplain. And that there's also 100 feet buffer beyond the edge of the riparian wetlands or flood hazard areas. That's a pretty big area. And I just appreciate being able to put that into perspective. Also, I appreciate your last comment as far as being able to look, because it says statewide control area. So that means that you are taking on the responsibilities and the understanding that we have a state with many types of climate. And so I appreciate that, and I thank you. You guys have certainly given me a lot of information I really didn't know about any of this plant until I got here today. So thank you for all the information on both presentations.
I'm going to call on Representative McEwen, followed by Representative Frederick, and committee members, please keep in mind that we need to be out of this room literally in a couple of minutes here.
So I will keep it very short. Sir, I appreciate your being here and helping educate us on the work that you have done to allay the fears of some of the issues that were brought up by the prior panel. And it sounds like what you have done at PGE is help the Department of Ag start to build this cadre of rules that are going to help us manage this crop. I have a question on number 7, Ms. Koba, in your handout, and it's talking about the ornamentals, and it says the lower risk of ornamental or woodwind reed plants, and I know they grow this for woodwinds, is being phased out in the nursery trade, but then it says only variegated varieties may be sold in Oregon for ornamental or woodwind reed purposes. Is this what's happening down in southern Oregon? Is this the feral populations that you're finding getting out that we need to try and figure out a way to control? And this may be answered another time. I mean, I know we're short on time, and Representative Frederick has a question. So if you want to get back to me on that, it's perfectly fine.
Mr. Chair,
I have a question on the ornamental piece.
Representative McEwen, we've got staff here. Maybe we can catch up with you after the
hearing.
Catch
you in the
hall. Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Frederick.
And you can get back to me on this as well. But I am concerned about something that was brought up that is not there. This plant requires a lot of water. If it's going to be grown in Central Oregon, we don't have a lot of water there, and this is a concern of how we put that in perspective. If we're going to be pulling water out of the Columbia, if we're going to be pulling water out of the aquifer, how are we going to do that in order to grow this plant, and what kind of impact does that have? As we're next meeting, we'll once again be bringing up the juniper issues in terms of water, the way that particular plant pulls water out of the system, and we don't want to be pulling a lot of water out of the system.
Chair Witt, Representative Frederick, I'll just briefly. We found that this plant uses about the same amount of water as the other plants that it was replacing. So alfalfa or corn, about 2 to 3 acre feet a year was more than sufficient to grow the plant. So we're not drawing any additional water than the current agricultural commodity crops are using. And I can follow up with you.
Will you please? I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Committee members, I feel that as a committee, we have an obligation to hear from the scientific community on this. I think that that's an obligation that we need to see through and hear testimony both possibly from the department's scientists. I think it might make sense perhaps some scientists from OSU. I'm inclined to hold this hearing over until we can complete that record. I want to make absolutely sure that we keep that genie in the bottle. With that, I'm going to hold over the hearing on House Bill 2183 until a future date to be announced. With that, I'm going to close today's hearing on that. Thank you all very, very much, and we stand adjourned. Adjourned.